Hello. Welcome to our CMD Bite Size series. In these podcasts, we will be exploring a range of ministry and theological issues. Good morning and welcome to our latest CMD podcast. This morning I'm talking with Susanna Cornwall, who is the Professor of Constructive Theologies at the University of Exeter. So welcome, Susanna, and thank you for joining me today. Can you tell me, to begin with, a bit about your role at the University of Exeter, what you do?
Yeah, of course. Hi, nice to be talking to you all. So I am the director of ECCEPT, which stands for the Exeter Centre for Ethics and Practical Theology. I teach on our degrees at the University of Exeter, like BA Theology and Religion, BA Religion, Culture and Society, and MA Theology and Religion. And really my teaching ranges from first year introductory modules on things like constructive theology and religion in the modern world, to upper level modules on things like theology and trauma, queer theologies, trans studies, post-colonial theologies. I'm also a researcher and I've published books on areas such as intersex and theology, marriage and family, queer theology and trans theologies. And I've got a new book which will be out next year, which is on structural sin and institutions, thinking in particular about things like institutional racism and sexual abuse cover-ups, and really the ways that institutions of all kinds can disempower people and make it hard to speak out in ways that might jeopardise the future of the institution.
Okay, thank you. That's a hugely broad range of things that you cover there. And it sounds like your book would be really a good time for that to come out as well, especially with all the safeguarding issues that we've had recently and the things on institutional racism, which are still quite key for the Church of England. So it'll be a really interesting read, I'm sure. So you covered lots of different areas of theology that you look at. And today we're thinking specifically about trans theology. Just so that we make sure we're all from at the same starting point, can you give us a brief overview of what you mean by trans theology?
Yes, of course. I mean, I guess trans theologies could just mean any theology done about trans people and trans identity. But more specifically, really, I'm interested in theologies by trans and non-binary people. So I'll talk about those terms in a second for anyone that's a bit less familiar with them. But really, these theologies don't have as a starting point an assumption that God couldn't speak and work in trans people's lives and experiences just as much as anybody else's. As most people listening probably will know, when we talk about trans people, we mean people who have a gender identity that doesn't necessarily fit alongside their body, their physiology, in a way that other people might expect. So some people might, some trans people might change their name or their pronouns or both. Some might take hormone therapy or have surgeries to help their body to fit their sense of self better. And then some people identify as non-binary, which kind of means they don't feel that either just masculine or just feminine identity and expression does justice to who they are. In terms of theologies, a lot of trans theologies to date have focused on pastoral care, and in particular the ways that congregations can be welcoming and affirming spaces for trans and non-binary people. Some of my favourite kind of insights really come from Justin Tannis, who's a trans theologian in the US, and he talks about the idea that really gender is a vocation or a calling, and that that goes for everybody, not just for trans people. And when you think about gender as a vocation, it kind of opens up lots of really interesting things, because he kind of says, you know, when we think about vocation, we know that sometimes vocation can kind of be really clear and obvious and something you sort of realise all at once, but sometimes it can come to light a bit more gradually. We also know that somebody's calling could be really constant throughout their whole lives, or they might be called to a particular thing for a particular season. And I really like the way he thinks of gender in those terms also. Somebody else that people might like to know about, whose work I really value, is Alex Clare Young, who's a non-binary theologian and a minister in the United Reformed Church here in Britain, who talks a lot about the motif of transformation in theology. And really, they argue that trans people can help other people who are not trans to understand more about what it means to be transformed more into the likeness of God. So Alex Clare Young talks about their sense that actually, if we kind of think about the gospel, transformation and change and new life are at the heart of it. Those are all things that trans people are really familiar with. And in particular, Alex talks about sort of feeling really strongly that God calls them not despite the fact that they're trans, but because they're trans, and that's a really kind of important aspect. And then people might also have come across Rachel Mann. So particularly within the Church of England, Rachel Mann is a C of E archdeacon and has served on General Synod for in the last quinquennium. People might have come across her because she's got a fairly high media profile on radio and things like that. She's published absolutely tons of books on all kinds of topics, from Elton John, Jane Austen, First World War remembrance, but also material on illness and embodiment, and also gender. And one of the things that she says in her book Dazzling Darkness, which is about gender and vocation, really, she says, you know, for Christians, we know that growing into being more like Christ and growing kind of more into our authentic selves, there might be some provisional and flexible meanings in all that, you know, as well as what we think of as more timeless ones. So again, she's kind of saying that goes for trans people and other people alike. But I think it's a really good reminder that, you know, Christians are always really already really used to the idea that actually the Holy Spirit sometimes shows things in a new way, perhaps disrupts things that people thought they already knew. So I find that really interesting. There are theologians also who've looked at particular Bible figures who might be understood as behaving in kind of gender non-conforming ways. Figures like the eunuchs, who some scholars and interpreters see as sort of almost forerunners of present day trans people. And then church historians who, again, have identified narratives of what we might now call trans or gender diverse figures within the tradition. You know, scholars of patristics and early Christian theology who are finding appeals to gender crossing in, you know, really significant early Christian theologians like Gregory of Nyssa way back in the first few centuries. So I guess all of that is to say, really, trans theologies are very, very diverse in terms of their methods and their approaches. But also, really, they make clear that, you know, trans people are nothing new. And also that plenty of people, including Christians, have very often been less anxious about trans people and trans identity at kind of earlier points in history than lots of people seem to be today. When I was talking to some people in Truro last year, there was a particular quotation that I read out that some people thought was really interesting. So I'll read that today again for people that are listening. So this is from a sermon by John Wallace. So he was an Anglican priest and Doctor of Divinity in the 17th century. And I came across this through Miranda Threlfall Holmes, who's a C of E priest and a historian. So this quotation comes from a sermon that John Wallace was giving, where he was thinking about miracles. He was thinking about the raising of Lazarus and also the virgin birth and things, and about how likely it was that those things really happened. And he says this: "It's not much more than what pretty often happens amongst men when God gives both sexes to the same person. Such there are and have been, and I think there is one yet living who was first as a woman married to a man and is and is since as a man married to a woman. And what hinders them but that God, if he please, may mingle the effects of both these sexes in the same body? A little alteration in the structure of the vessels would do it. So it's not necessarily clear there whether he's talking about what we would now call a trans person or whether he's talking about an intersex person. And I might say more about intersex in a minute. But I think it's important to say that, you know, before we could do things like analysing people's chromosomes in the way we can now, or kind of find out whether they've got testes or ovaries while they're still alive, those categories probably overlapped quite a bit anyway. But I guess the point is that, you know, here we've got just one example of an Anglican cleric several hundred years ago who isn't really anxious or isn't really exercised that these things sometimes happen and are part of the rich fabric of creation. So, yeah, I find that really interesting.
Thank you. That was a really comprehensive introduction. And I was just found it incredibly insightful, actually, particularly that idea about transforming and what we can learn, because I think it's so important that we don't lose sight of what we can always learn from other people. It's a very broad church. We're very diverse, but actually we can always learn things from other people. And that idea of transforming being at the heart of the gospel has really struck me. And particularly, I think as humans, we can generally become very focused on routine, traditions, disliking change. And so to actually identify this as a particular area where quite often the churches seem to need to change now is a really helpful analysis. So thank you for that. You're obviously very passionate about this area. Is there anything in particular that inspired or motivated you to study this?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually interested first in intersex variations. So what I mean by intersex is when people are born whose bodies can't be classified as male or female, perhaps because they've got a mix of characteristics. For example, somebody might have XY chromosomes, which normally we would think of as male, but actually they've got female genitalia at birth, or who, for example, rather than having testes or ovaries, have got one of each, for example. So it seemed to me that actually the existence of intersex people just disrupted any assumption that human sex is always clear and binary. And so from there, I was interested in what that meant for theology, particularly things like theological anthropology, kind of thinking about what it means to be human with relation to God and to other creatures. But also, you know, implications for Christian teachings about sexuality, which again often just assume the universality of clear and binary sex. So when I was doing that research about 20 years ago, there wasn't so much theological work done on intersex, but what there was writings by trans theologians. So people like Tina Beardsley, who's retired now as a Church of England priest, but spent a lot of her career in healthcare chaplaincy, who were really way ahead of me. So intersex and trans people's experience are not the same thing, but they do both require us to think really hard, I think, about how universal the kind of cultural and religious narratives about sex and gender that we've received really are. For most of the time that I've been studying gender from a kind of theological point of view, people haven't really been that interested in trans theologies or kind of taken much notice. But in the last decade in particular, we've seen a really big backlash against trans people in the media, rollbacks of trans people's rights in some political jurisdictions. There's been a lot of anxiety about trans healthcare, you know, things like toilets and changing rooms and all sorts in Britain, but also beyond. We're recording this like less than a week into the second Trump administration in the US, and people have been following the news about, you know, some of the things that President Trump is doing. One of the things he did on his very first day in office this week was he's ordered the repeal of various protections for trans people that had existed in the Biden administration. He's issued an executive order saying male and female are going to be the only two sexes recognised in law. He's ordered the Department of Homeland Security to ensure that government-issued ID documents like passports only list biological sex at birth. And he's said that federal funding can't be used to promote gender ideology. That's a really slippery term. What he seems likely to mean is that any trans-affirming perspectives will not be allowed. So, you know, that could mean, for example, that funding will be taken away from any state-funded schools that are pastorally caring for and pastorally supporting young people who don't identify with their sex assigned at birth. This seems to be part of a wider thing around rescinding protections against anti-LGBTQ harassment and bullying in schools and workplaces, kind of removing existing legal protections that exist. Now, that is a symptom, I think, of this social and political anxiety about trans people that has arisen really very rapidly. And it seems to me, at least, that, you know, trans people are really being scapegoated. And I think one of the reasons why they're being scapegoated is as a way to deflect attention from other things like, you know, the climate emergency and economic inequalities and, you know, especially in the US, things like lack of access to healthcare, as well as, you know, those familiar intractable problems that we all know about, like sexual abuse and male violence against women. So I think for me, you know, learning from trans theologies and learning about trans theologies is also a really crucial aspect of ensuring that as Christian theologians and you know, ministers and others, we kind of don't get sidetracked into blaming the wrong people for the challenges that we're facing in the world or kind of being distracted into looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah, thank you for that. And thank you for relating it to something so current as well. We've seen throughout history, haven't we, different races, different groups of people being scapegoated for things as order, sort of through propaganda to distract from things that are really going on. And actually, as Christians, we're called to work with people that are on the margins, those that are struggling with different things. And so it's really important, I think, that we're aware of what's going on fully and have a good understanding of different people's perspectives. And that takes us, you know, requires us to listen well to people without judging them. So thank you for that. That's really helpful. You mentioned when you were talking about your research over the years that kind of there wasn't much information on trans theology when you first started, and that's progressed quite a lot. Just over that time, I guess there's been lots of changes in thought patterns and things. Is there anything that you've changed your mind on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I do change my mind about lots of things. I think in this area in particular, I know when I sort of talk to people about trans identity and about gender and sexuality more broadly, I know one thing people are often anxious about is kind of terminology, because you might have grown up using a particular set of language or terminology and it kind of changes and shifts over time. And a word that you use kind of innocently, you know, you might find now somebody kind of is offended by and isn't considered appropriate. And that can be really hard, you know, particularly if you were very well-meaning and, you know, you didn't know that, you know, the term that you were using, you know, was seen in a different way now. So I kind of think it goes along with what you were talking about a minute ago, really, which is kind of saying, you know, we know that things shift and we know that things change. And part of being, I guess, engaged in our world as Christians is acknowledging that change and kind of being aware of it. So, you know, terminology would be one thing. I guess it's not a change of mind as such, but I think that one thing I know differently perhaps than I did when I started out on this is, you know, now that I know lots and lots of trans people, which I didn't when I started this, you know, but now I know lots of trans people, including Christians and people from other faith traditions, people with no faith. I've come to realise really how much public discourse about trans people is based in fear of the unknown, right? And actually how little of the theology, which is a bit more suspicious about trans identity, is written by anyone who knows actual trans people. I guess on top of that, it seems like an obvious thing to say, really, but, you know, I know now more than I did before that the trans community is not kind of monolithic. different trans people who've got really different beliefs and concerns and preoccupations and self-understandings and needs and all the rest of it, which shouldn't really surprise us. I think in general, I've also learned lots and lots about trans people's histories and kind of the history of their legal status that I didn't know before. There's a great book by Zoe Playden, who's a historian, called The Hidden Case of Ewan Forbes. And this is about a 1968 Scottish legal case. And this ruled that Ewan Forbes, who was a transgender GP, part of an aristocratic family, the court case ruled that he was entitled to inherit his father's estate rather than it passing to a male cousin. And at the time, the laws of primogeniture said only a son can inherit, a daughter can't inherit. And the court's finding that Ewan Forbes, who'd been born a girl, should be considered male rather than female in law, really mattered. You know, it mattered to him not only because of his inheritance, but also because if he had been ruled legally female, that would have made his marriage to a woman void. You know, he was married, he had a wife, and he didn't want to be found to have committed perjury or for the marriage not to be valid. And in her book, Zoe Playden argues that the reason why this court ruling wasn't made public at the time it happened, even though Ewan Forbes won the case, was that it would have set a precedent for challenging male primogeniture, and in essence, that was really just too threatening to the establishment. And, you know, this case wasn't known about till a long time later. So, you know, that's just one example of a really significant figure about whom I didn't know anything. And I think, again, it sort of drives home that our theologies are always being done in a wider context where there are political, legal, economic, all sorts of other things going on.
Thank you. Yes, it's just often you see some of these things coming down to power, don't you? And the kind of power imbalance and how different things affect people's power and how that silences people within that. I think within that you gave a really helpful reminder of not kind of grouping all trans people as being the same, because often we tend to do that, don't we, as kind of unconscious bias. We sort of think of a group of people, but we don't do that so much with male and female. So that's really helpful. I've also been reflecting a bit on this fear of the unknown, and somebody shared with me recently the image of a Sankofa bird that kind of looks backwards and holds an egg in its mouth so that it is thinking about what it takes forward. And I think for me, that's been really helpful in reflecting on what sort of experience I've had as a child, what sort of things have I inherited from how people have reacted to different people around me, and are those things valid, or are they, have I just kind of come up with, oh, I don't like that, or I'm scared of that because people have had a negative reaction to them. And I think as churches, we should constantly challenge ourselves to think about, actually, when we look backwards, why do we feel something about that particular thing? Is it because of we've had negative imagery put on us or negative experiences, or is it a valid thing? And I think we ought to be much better at churches as kind of thinking about that past and then looking forward to actually what does come next, because, you know, the Bible's not static, is it? It changes. There's lots of changes that are going on all the time. We shouldn't always think that actually what we've got now is the answer.
That's really interesting. Yeah, definitely.
Do you have any thoughts, because we try and relate this podcast specifically to Cornwall, so on what trans theology has to do with Cornwall, how it might specifically relate to our rural context?
Yeah, I suppose the first thing to say is that, you know, we might often think about LGBTQ plus people as kind of living in and around mainly big cities, right? And, you know, there's some truth to that, you know, not least because you might find perhaps better access to particular services in big cities. But of course, there are, you know, trans people and other LGBTQ plus people everywhere in all kinds of communities. So, you know, like anywhere else, people in Cornwall will have people in their families and workplaces and even churches who are negotiating questions about gender. You know, some people in Cornwall will be living in perhaps quite small and close-knit communities, and that can be a bit double-edged, I think. In some ways it feels really nice to be part of a community that knows you and recognises you, but I also think perhaps if you are negotiating aspects of your identity, perhaps particularly if you feel that the way people have known you up until now doesn't really represent the truth about you. I think perhaps it can feel a bit claustrophobic and isolating if maybe you're not somebody who, you know, has the luxury to travel somewhere else to sort of find a critical mass of people like you. But I think, you know, from my experience, one thing that people in somewhere like Cornwall are really good at is recognising that majority reports don't always tell the whole story. So, for example, you know, we know that political legislation made in London doesn't always seem like it's really taken seriously what it is like to live somewhere very far from London, you know, the concerns and experiences of people living elsewhere. You know, we know also that the way that the media portrays things doesn't necessarily tell the whole story. So I think what I'm saying is that, you know, our context and our life experiences matter for how we encounter and understand the world. Similarly, I think people who experience the world as trans and non-binary are also reminding us that majority reports, in this case about sex and gender, you know, systems and patterns that maybe seem to fit most people quite well, don't fit everybody. And that, of course, has got implications for theology. I'm guessing lots of people ministering in Cornwall, well, some will have really massive congregations scattered across a, you know, a big geographic area. Some people might have really quite small congregations in terms of numbers. But, you know, I hope people in Cornwall wouldn't say only big congregations matter. You know, that doesn't seem to go along with people's experience. So, again, trans identity might apply only to a minority of people. But I think it can be a prompt to all of us to, you know, as you were saying a minute ago, really, to ask those suspicious questions about the narratives that have come down to us, and about whose experiences they've served and whose they haven't served, and whether there might be other pictures of human identity that give us a new or a different insight into what it means to be a person made in God's image and who also shapes their own life story.
Thank you. One of the expressions we often use in the diocese is that a satsuma is not a failed orange. Talking specifically about actually small congregations, small places are just as valid. So, and I think one thing that I found really helpful about what you said was that idea of sometimes it's more obvious that there's diversity in those smaller congregations, but rather than noting that as being different, and when we were talking previously about political things about othering people and blaming and scapegoating people, actually being really intentional about looking for what are the similarities. So actually it might be that someone feels discriminated against because of their gender or because of their identity, but equally people in rural communities feel discriminated against, as you said, from things that come down from big cities, and actually trying to look at the kind of similarity there is really helpful for people.
Oh, good, I'm glad.
If there was one thing that you would like listeners to take away from this podcast, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, I would love people to seek out some of the really good resources that exist that are really specifically designed to help Christian congregations think through questions of gender. And, you know, for those congregations who decide that they want to take really practical steps towards becoming safe and affirming places for trans people, you know, whether you already know a trans people in your community or not. So I mentioned a book earlier by Rachel Mann, and I'd really heartily recommend that. It's called Dazzling Darkness: Gender, Sexuality, Illness and God. And she reflects on her gender journey in the context of wider realities, like her experience of chronic illness, but also her calling to ordained ministry. It's a really brilliant book. I mentioned Alex Clare Young. Their book, Transgender Christian Human, is also really brilliant. And then in terms of, I suppose, really practical nuts and bolts stuff. So Christina Beardsley and Chris Dowd have got two books in particular. So one's called Trans Faith, and that contains things like prayers for people transitioning gender, you know, which they hope one day might become approved liturgy, although they're not at the moment. And then the other one is called Trans Affirming Churches: How to Celebrate Gender Variant People and Their Loved Ones. And that, I think, is particularly useful for clergy and lay ministers negotiating how to take care of trans people's family members, too. So those are some books that I'd really encourage people to look out for. I guess I'd also want to encourage people really to take certain media portrayals of trans people, or, you know, a sinister trans agenda, with a pinch of salt, really. And like I said earlier, really, to ask whose interests it's in to be directing all of our attention and anxiety and fury towards trans people, particularly trans women, rather than other things that are going on in terms of inequality and oppression in the world.
Thank you. And that's really helpful. And the reading list sounds excellent. We definitely have to get some of those for our library as well, so that people can borrow those from here. So thank you so much for giving us your time today. It's been really insightful to speak with you and to hear more about and understand more about what trans theology means. And wish you all the best of luck with your new publication next year.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to talk. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to CMD Bite Size Podcasts, produced by the Diocese of Truro. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do follow and share. To listen to similar podcasts, please visit the Truro Diocese website. If there is a subject you would like us to include, please email us at ministry@truro.anglican.org.